Hi there, fellow internet consumer. Has your grandma ever died because an article online convinced her that her dementia medicine was made of nanobots? Did an AI video of a man hugging a shark convince your friend to get himself eaten? I know I have. And that's why we started this podcast. Welcome to What Is True. We know you're drowning in information every day, in fake AI videos and fake articles, and who knows what other kind of horrendous disinformation. I'm Alexa Battler.
And I'm Chris Garbutt. Together, we're going to talk about the ways facts get twisted, about the tools we can use to spot those twists, and why this matters for everyone from a teenager scrolling TikTok to a retiree checking the news over morning coffee.
Each episode this season, we'll sit down with Nina Vereshchagin and Diane Zur, the best people we could find to help us answer this question. They're two media literacy experts from Saskatchewan Polytechnic. They've spent pretty much their whole careers helping people cut through the bullcrap, and they co-authored the open source textbook, Disinformation, Dealing with the Disaster, a fantastic resource, which is how we found them, and one that we'll reference throughout the season and that you can access for free along with their course on media literacy online.
This problem keeps evolving. Our goal is to map that evolution and give you practical ways to stay ahead.
Each week, Nina and Diane will help us break down real-world situations, highlight real tools from their book you can use in your everyday life, and point you towards free resources you can start using right now to stop being lied to.
No lectures, just straight talk about what you can actually do when a story makes you pause, when an emotion spikes, or when you're tempted to share.
It's the information age, baby, and it's an age when it's harder than ever to figure out what is true. So here's our best crack at an answer.
Look for What Is True on your favorite podcast platform.
I wanted to start with the fact that really irritates me actually a lot. I start a lot of things with rants nowadays, but like everything is a reboot now. But my pitch is to preemptively say that there is absolutely no way to reboot one of the most iconic pieces of Canadiana of all time. There's no way to reboot The House Hippo. All is quiet. And for those who don't know, and they tried in 2019. The North American and House Hippo. The horrors are so far beyond what anyone in the 90s could have even envisioned that I don't even know how you would reboot this thing. The House Hippo featured in these public service announcements that if you grew up in Canada in the 90s and 2000s, you saw a million of these. There's this nonprofit concerned children's advertisers. And they made this in a lot of other different ads. And the thing that they did that was really cool was that they put a lot of effort into making this look real for 1999. And it looks like a hinterland Who's Who, which is another Canadian staple, about the House Hippo. And there's these tiny hippos. And they're pests, and they hide in your cupboards, and they crap in your pet's water bowl when you're sleeping. They're wreaking havoc at night, and they're just hard to spot. And it holds up. And then at the end of the ad, they go like, ha ha, got you. What they actually said, quote, but you knew it couldn't be true, didn't you? That's why it's good to think about what you're watching on TV and ask questions, kind of like how you just did. A message from concerned children's advertisers. And we all went like, I mean, when I was a kid, I was like, oh, my God, I want one. Because I was not listening to the voiceover at the end, obviously. But it was like actively warning us about by doing it themselves was showing that like someone else might use this cool new technology that's coming out to trick you into thinking something that isn't true. And they may have a very specific purpose for wanting you to believe something. But I don't think anyone in 1999 could have known how unbelievably bad things were going to get. Like, how do you explain to this kid that the TV is going to become a supercomputer that lives in your pocket? And if you want to participate in most of society, you actually have to use it, including getting an education. The TV and pretty much everything on it that lives in your pocket has been now shaped by like generations and decades of evil scientists who maliciously designed all of this to be as addictive as possible because now you are the product. And to me, most importantly, if you saw that nowadays, you would have to articulate to them like, the House Hippo video that you're seeing might be created by a bot acting autonomously, which was programmed to generate a steady feed of AI-generated House Hippo content. Not because the goal is like to trick you into thinking that's real anymore, but because the goal is to get you to follow that Twitter account. And if you follow it and like and retweet those House Hippo videos, your algorithm is going to learn that you like content from this user. And it'll send you more content from them, often higher in your feed. When that account hits 10,000 followers, it's going to be untraceably sold to a mysterious right-wing organization, possibly funded by a malicious government actor intending to like sow division in the West. That literally happens a lot. But who knows? They use crypto. Can't tell. And the account's new owners are slowly going to start replacing House Hippo content with red pill incel content, which you will interact with first out of confusion. And then the algorithm will think that your confusion is actually genuine interest and it'll show you more and more and more. my toilet's everywhere. And this is no longer a matter of, okay, let's turn off the TV or just let's think critically, because of course a house hippo can't be that size. It is like a powder keg, and it preys on you. Now, the more desperate you are for community and connection, the more that these creatures are going to seek you out and find you. And now your feed is full of right-wing neo-Nazi memes, and you're a threat to the public. That's now what the threat of the house hippo is. I say all this to introduce the two people that we have with us, who on a much higher and more complicated level have been trying to crack this nut for a very long time, of how you prepare people for this environment. How do we reboot? How do you remake the house hippo and teach people how to be critical of the media when it got so out of hand so far? Because we're so far gone. So I'm here, though, with two people, Nina Vereshchagin.
We're going to help us through this.
Yeah, Nina Vereshchagin and Diane Zur. Yeah. Nina, can I get a hell yeah?
Hi, hell yeah.
Nice. And Diane?
Hello.
Hi. Do you want the hell yeah,
if you're
too?
Comfortable.
No, hell yeah.
Confirmed. Awesome. So you guys have both dedicated your lives to the study of information. That's what librarians do. You've worked for many years at Saskatchewan Polytechnic. Nina is now a full-time instructor for the Library and Information Technology program, and Diane is a learning services instructor. And you've both had long careers essentially in the house hippo industry, which is a really stupid way to say that they've been spending years trying to teach people media literacy or trying to teach people the skills that they actually need, figure out how to find high-quality information and how to identify false information. The era of the house hippo, if anyone remembers, was also kind of the era of kids going into the computer lab and the librarians would come in and teach you how to do research online and like teach you Wikipedia is not a reliable source, but you could find reliable sources in Wikipedia by just stealing the ones that they used. And things were simple back then because those were house hippo days. But just to Nina and Diane, I wanted to kind of ask you to look back. What did it look like trying to teach media literacy when you started out? Nina, you would have been as a faculty librarian at Saskatchewan Polytechnic. Diane, either when you were at the Regina Public Library or as an instructional librarian at Saskatchewan Polytechnic. What were your challenges back at that point?
It was easier because we could rely on things like the website address to determine whether or not something might be a reliable source, or there just wasn't as much information on the internet, or it was coming in one form. It was generally written. Occasionally, there would be videos. The internet didn't look the same. So it was easier to teach people, these are the things to look for. You can use a checklist. You can decide whether or not something is a good source or a bad source. And that's how we started our careers, is we were doing these sessions with students where we would basically have a checklist and they'd be able to go through it and determine whether or not they could use that information for an academic paper.
Yeah, and usually that was the context, was they were doing an academic paper. And what we were providing them is called information literacy instruction. And essentially it's teaching people to find the information that they need for something in particular, and understand how to use it effectively and how to evaluate it. We were just looking at like research papers back then. But over time, as the internet became much more sophisticated, students and faculty members, and I would assume in the public library this exploded as well, people were more concerned about finding accurate information in their personal lives as well. So it really evolved into like a much bigger beast. The house hippo grew much, much larger.
You two are also here because you literally wrote the book on disinformation. And if anyone can reboot the house hippo, it's going to be you guys. Nina and Diane have designed a fantastic course. This is how we found them and why we brought them on. And they have later written a textbook. Both of them are titled Disinformation, Dealing with the Disaster. They're both fantastic free open source resources that you can use to try to better navigate just this disaster. I mean, you mentioned that you called it that partly for the alliteration in the keyword, but that it is, you know, they're not good. Nina, you actually had a story about the student. I was wondering if you could share that actually motivated you to create this course and then this textbook. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. Just reflecting back on what Diane said about how we used to be able to teach checklist methods. And actually, you'll see in the book that we do still recommend the use of a checklist method sometimes, depending on what situation the searcher is in. because sometimes you just need something quick and easy to get through. You can't like do the most in-depth research on everything all the time. Anyway, so I was teaching checklist methods to students for close to a decade, and we were approaching the pandemic. And I actually also at the time thought that good information was like trumping bad information. And I think that's because of my algorithms. Yeah. I think it's because I, like, my Google and my socials and everything had figured out who I was. And so I was getting all the good stuff. And it was actually becoming more and more challenging for me to find bad information when I was trying to, like, plan my classes and show students examples and stuff like that. Anyways, things are getting worse. We're coming into the pandemic. We're in the pandemic. And I'm still working from home, delivering sessions to students on finding good information. And the session that sort of like was the origin story, I guess you would call, of our big project, it was a session about current events. An instructor had asked me to come and talk to her students about like where to find current events, where to find good information in the media, stuff like that. And I said to the students, where do you go to read news or learn news or learn about current events? Because I knew that they might say, you know, I was expecting them to say like Facebook or TV or radio or something like that. And one student sort of put their hand up and said, I don't read articles online. When I go to an article that interests me, I scroll to the bottom and I read all the comments, because to me, the conversations that are happening back and forth in the comments is more legitimate information. And those people are better sources because they're just normal everyday people like me. And I must have had like a 10-second pause where I just like stared blankly into the Zoom screen and thought, oh my God, like I have to do something. And so I reached out to Diane and I said to her, like, what we're doing is fine. It's not enough. We need to figure something out. We need to do some sort of project. And that resulted in our 3.5 to 4 hour course that we created for students so that they could like self-paced learn it and just spend more time doing thinking and developing the skills necessary.
Yeah, and it's really well written. It's fairly engaging, both the course and the textbook. There's a lot of just like really, I would call them just like fun facts, but they're not fun. But you know, it tracks throughout history quite a bit in a really approachable way that you wouldn't really think it's a textbook. It's written very accessibly. So something to bring up is that the book focuses quite a bit on COVID, and the world is like obviously so vastly different than that already. What also happened just before COVID was the actual reboot of the House Hippo, if you knew. In 2019, they brought back the House Hippo ad. I guess it became the intellectual property of the nonprofit Media Smarts, and they call themselves Canada's Center for Digital Media Literacy. And they brought back the House Hippo in like an ad right before COVID. Looking back at it now, it just sucks. I'm sorry. It means, well, it leads to a really helpful resource, but like it doesn't even make sense anymore. By 2019, even the concept and the ethos behind the commercial doesn't make sense. They show footage of like the House Hippos and say, well, now they're way better at hiding than ever. And there's this like, it also will like now go on your phone while you're sleeping, which leads to this hilarious shot where it looks like the House Hippo is like trying to steal your credit card information on your cell phone. And then they like widen the rotoscoping on the hippo head to reveal, there's a green screen, which everybody absolutely knew already. And the narrator says, and I quote, "We brought the House Hippo back to show how easy it is to be fooled in our digital world. Find out how to tell what's real and what's not at breakthefake.ca," end quote. Which, I'm sorry, how did bringing back a now laughably reductive campaign and just recreating it shot for shot, how does that articulate the threat of disinformation, the evolving at that point threat, already having evolved from the 1989 threat of disinformation, when like this threat has now killed countless people, bolstered wars, manipulated democracies? And to their credit, if you click on that breakthefake.ca, it's a really good website. It's really decked out, and they've clearly been continuously updating it since 2019. The Photoshop of the hippo at the top, because like that was kind of the thing. Like, you were supposed to think it was real, and then they just kind of like phoned in the Photoshop in the second edition when we're already like really good now at telling when something is CGI. It is a well-intentioned piece, and that goes to a really robust piece of, or a really robust website. There's like tip sheets on spotting deepfakes. There's a search engine that only looks up like verified news sites. Really cool. And it says something at the top of the screen that I wanted to bring up. Again, the Photoshop of the hippo is, I'm being a jerk. But it says, quote, "The house hippo is here to remind you to check before you share anything you see online. Find out how below." And as a reminder, the original commercial said nothing about like your role in worsening the spread of house hippos. But that's now where we are. We're warning like 10-year-olds not to blindly share fake articles. Am I convinced grandma there's like 5G nanobots in her dementia medicine and now she's going to die? I wanted to get your thoughts on that slogan and how it's changed and whether that resonates with you, that check before you share anything you see on, like, does that land with you now in 2025?
That's not a bad practice.
No, I think it's a good practice too, actually.
I would say pause. Check, evaluate your emotions, because that's usually what disinformation is playing upon, is your emotions. Right. So if you are feeling a lot of things, and it doesn't matter, it can be happy stuff, it can be sad stuff, but if you're feeling a lot, like, just pause, because that's your first sign that it might be something else. But at the same time, it's not bad, but it's pretty simple.
I would say, well, first of all, I'm going to advocate for media smart, because I remember actually a few years ago, me and Dan were looking at creating something for children, have young children. And so we were sort of in that conversation about like the, you mentioned it earlier, Alexa, the like the terrifying web that they can get sucked into on YouTube, just from watching like crafting videos. All of a sudden they're on like these weird cartoons with like Russian accents. Have a lot of violence, and I'm like, I don't know what's going on here or how this happened. And so we actually found, when we were doing our, when we were thinking of doing that, I remember coming across Media Smarts and being like, oh, there's this website that has like packaged all of these amazing tools for parents and teachers. Like, we don't need to participate in this. It's there. And I've actually even looked and showed some of the videos to my students in my class, but they are, it's lower level, which so is check before you share anything you see online. That's like a lower level skill in this landscape of information disorder that we live in. However, there's going to be some people who are so entrenched in it. Like, there's generations of people who like really do not understand how they're being duped online, and they've gotten into such intense echo chambers of their specific viewpoints, that if they did just pause, as Diane said, and just checked their emotion, a lot of damage would actually, I think, be stopped. But it's probably like level one of like what we need to do. I think level 10 is like government mandates and, you know, businesses and not being allowed to do certain things to sell products, and, you know, getting good control of trolls and bots and propaganda machines and stuff like that. Is it a good slogan?
Yeah.
I think it's a good slogan for a lot of people. I think really people like who are very sophisticated in the field of disinformation can see that there's a lot more to it. But those who we're trying to educate and provide tools to, this might be the thing they need to hear to start anyways.
Also, I wanted to run, I read a lot of the like tip sheets and things that were on that website. They have kind of like a summary of the four steps that they recommend. And they're good. They're quite good. But I wanted to kind of run them past you guys as well and just see kind of what your interpretation. So like all of these steps link back to a bunch of other resources that help you with the steps. And there's a lot of like learning resources. But so for those steps, what we have is, one, use fact-checking tools. And then it says, see if a fact-checker like Snopes.com has debunked the story. Is that still solid advice?
Yeah. If you just do, it can be any sort of internet search. Put in there debunked or is this misinformation or anything like that. The key is not to just click on the top result. Don't just look at the AI result. You actually have to scroll and look at, just do a scan of all the information, and hopefully Snopes has done it, because they still do debunk things. But generally, if it is a pretty well-known scam or a disinformation campaign, it'll be debunked online somewhere. There'll be multiple sources. That's what you're looking for.
You can use like keywords to your advantage there of like specifically. I've done that a lot with like if I'm about to buy something on a shady looking website, you just look up like scam at the end. And then, but you've touched on something that like I don't even know how we get. I don't even know where to start when it comes to those AI generated. Like in terms of disinformation and misinformation, like I can't even touch that yet. Back burner.
Need a whole season on AI, I think.
Yeah.
And I think maybe what you're even if Nopes has debunked something, or even if some like you still don't know for sure. Like it's just such like a convoluted huge problem. But I think that if a person is looking at like a piece of information that seems dangerous and they take the minute to Google and actually like verify it, even if it doesn't change their mind or it doesn't have a huge impact, it's more critical thinking, and it's causing them to like use their brains a little bit more than just like reading a title and sharing it and not looking at the article and whatever, which is like how a lot of this stuff blows up really quickly.
It's a lot of it's been like engineered specifically.
Yeah, I'm thinking we need to introduce more friction into our information landscape so the lie doesn't spread around the world in seconds rather than, at least a few minutes.
Well, we can talk too about like if there's any other Snopes.com go-to websites that you guys have, because that seems like one of the most straightforward. If you do trust a site like Snopes, but then let's say you like look into Nope.
I don't even think there is though. Yeah, like I don't know, Diane, you might disagree, but to me it's one of those, it's like how we used to be able to teach checklists and then we were good and things were done. But now it's like, oh, Snopes is good. And this website's good, but I don't know, they might not be good tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes when I'm looking for disinformation and looking for debunking, I end up on like Reddit and I'm just looking at what people are talking about and what sites they're linking to and what information they have. And it really is like a full-time job that you really have to think about it a lot.
Which, and it's interesting to situate Reddit specifically in the context of comment sections. That's just a big comment section, right?
Yeah.
And it does link to,
the person looking at it has to be the one doing the critical thinking and looking at where, like, who's saying it and where it's coming from and stuff like that, which is the essence of what we try to teach.
Well, so that leads well into the second step. It says of find the source on the website. Click on the link in a social media post to take you to the original story so you can see if it comes from a trusted source. Even that, like, I could literally like create a one-to-one complete copy of a legitimate news source and then like an exact replica of the website with like one difference in the URL up at the top, and it can be a totally different
happens.
So it happens, like you said, it's like there's and then I guess you have to say, well, then click around to also make sure that it actually is the website and not an HTML of what it looked like at one
and that's
point.
Exactly what we would say,
right?
That's exactly what we would tell people to do.
Yeah, this one's actually, I don't know if it's possible. No. Sometimes it's really easy to find the source. If it's a really good source, they're not hiding themselves. They don't need to. You can just click and you're going to end up at an authoritative website. But I am sure there are plenty of things I have looked at online where it's like a meme or something like that. Good luck trying to find where that originated. What's the purpose of it? Who started it? No, you're never going to find it. And the best articles I've read are people that have tried to do this, like journalists and professionals that have tried to research it back. And the places they end up is fascinating. But I think that would be very challenging with a lot of our social media to get back to the source. But I think a good source doesn't need to hide itself. So if you can click on it and then follow back to the information and get back to the original data and the original study. If it's a good source, that's all going to be there.
And often many social stories or articles or memes especially won't have link. Mm-hmm. Like that is extremely common, but people don't pay attention to that or notice that. And then they share, this thing that says, I don't know, a banana gave me HIV or something like that, or a banana gave someone HIV and the bananas were from China and whatever. And then this causes like a massive hysteria, but it doesn't link to anything and it doesn't have any evidence. This is very something we see very commonly.
Right.
And with all of these situations, we would always say, like when we're teaching it in the classroom, for instance, we would always say, okay, you've gotten back to the source. Now, who is the author? Mm. You need to find out a little bit about them. Mm. And you need to understand this a little bit. And sometimes it is a terrible source, or it's a duplicate website or a copycat news site or something like that. And then the student learns something or the person learns something.
Well, now that is the other two steps, are to verify the source and to check other sources, which is pretty much what you've...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, if we were going to talk about it in the library, we'd probably call it lateral reading. And it just means, like, if something is true, probably many places have said the exact same thing or something similar. And so that's always a good way to check whether or not. And, like, in different areas, too. Don't just, oh, I seen it on Facebook 5 times. No, go to the internet, go to books, go to different sources. And if everything's saying the same thing, you can probably trust it.
For those people who just have like just enough time to double check something and then not share something dangerous, like thank goodness they did that, right? Would be my,
yes,
my thought on that.
Right. You could just live, I'm going to go a little extreme here, and you could just live a life of not sharing.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's the life I'm living. I don't share stuff on social media. I just don't do it. And then I never have this problem. So that is always an option too.
You just never log into anything. Do you never log into anything? Like, or do you have accounts that you just don't post anything?
I only have a couple accounts and I never post.
Does that keep you kind of safe from any algorithm manipulation? Or is that still going to...
No, I'm still getting fed exactly what they want me. Yeah. No, they figured me out. Like, I buy stuff online, so they know who I am.
Right. I think about that all the time when I like get distracted by something and I've accidentally been watching an ad for like the stupidest, that's something that like baby like diapers or something, like something has nothing to do with my life. And then it's everywhere because now I'm like these very advanced algorithms do not care about like the quality of your engagement. They just care about your getting you to engage. So we've all come back to kind of, and this website is as well, of like, the source, verifying the source, understanding the source, believing in the source is pretty quirky to this. Now, we used to live in a world where, like, the White House was a credible source. That's not really the case anymore, where, like, knowing exactly where it came from and knowing that it's from an institution, increasingly it seems like the motivations of the source itself are important to think about in terms of critical thinking. And there's kind of like this philosophical relationship, which you guys touched on quite a bit actually in the book, how much of media literacy now is like self-reflection and philosophically, or like critically looking at who's benefiting from this, who gets anything out of this and why. So
funny, because I remember I used to tell my students .gov was a reliable and like there's no way I would say that now.
Really?
But I think you can generally say like that any sort of ending now, .gov, .edu, that's just, again, it's not a good way to evaluate a website. It's just their address.
It used to be. It used to be like, if it's .edu or if it's .this, really then yes, it's good. It became that anybody could buy almost any domain. And I mean, we all know what's going on. Honestly, even any government website, you would have to think like, what's the purpose behind this? What is the motive behind this? Not insinuating all governments are untruthful, but they have motives also.
Yeah, the purpose can be the well-being of citizens. There's that the purpose often of government websites, but read it and determine, is that the case? And if it is, great. That's going to be good information, generally.
Well, I wanted to read this. This was published in 2022. It's on one of those Break the Fake tip sheets. It's trying to explain to kids in 2022 how important critical thinking is in disinformation. And I wanted to kind of get your thoughts on this quote. I think it kind of actually really encapsulates the root of the issue, or kind of, I guess, it presents an interesting hypothesis, or potentially could be why people fall for these things. But it's a quote, "We pay attention to things that fit with what we already think is true. That's not always a bad thing. Science, medicine, and other subjects all have a consensus. What experts believe is most likely true based on all the evidence that's been found so far. It's important to know what the consensus is on a topic when you're judging a claim or a new piece of information. And it's important not to reject something because it doesn't match what you already think or believe." And they specifically go into that. They're talking about a legitimate cognitive hindrance that we as humans experience, cognitive bias or confirmation bias, where we, if you already believe something and you see information that reinforces that, you're more likely to just immediately accept that and something that questions that, you're not as likely to go anywhere into it.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to bring up is that this is in a lot of ways like what people are doing when they pull up the comment section a little bit, because it totally makes sense to me that like people going from the comment section, like I think like during COVID especially, that was a really dangerous place. I'm wondering now if there's a high, like a happy medium between, because I would say like institutional distrust or like people's anger and resentment of institutions is skyrocketed. It's so high. In a lot of ways, like what people are doing when they pull up the comments, they're looking for like the public consensus, not the shaped message that the media has given you, sort of thing. And it could be an advantage that now we have both. Like we do have the official message and we have the public's reaction to it. The only thing is it's potentially not the public at all, even. That could be entirely the dead internet, AI bots reinforcing their own ideas and for who knows what reasons. So I just, Nina and Diane, how do you think people should view comment sections in relation to when they're also trying to verify a source? Do you think there's any value to be, like any, there's definitely some good jokes usually in the comment section. I love some good roasts usually. But what do you guys think?
Well, first what I'll say is we do talk about confirmation bias in the book, and we talk about actually a lot of different sort of psychological, I don't know if a lot, but some other psychological things that happen to individuals when they are, one has to do with repetition, which is the more times you see something, the more likely you are to believe it, which leads to a lot of spread of false information as well. And these are like proven psychological thing. And you mentioned confirmation bias. And yeah, essentially, it's exactly what you said, Alexis. It's you see something that you already believe to be true. It gives you this like emotional feeling of vindication, like, yeah, I knew I was right. And then you sort of want to like shove it in everybody else's faces because, you know, maybe a lot of people in your circle don't agree with you or something like that. And I think the really important thing to think about, and maybe this could go to comment sections as well, because on comment sections, you're going to have people who agree with the thing that they're looking at, and you're going to have people who disagree with the thing that you're looking at. So perhaps it is an okay place to do some more thinking for the individual who's looking at it. And that leads to my point of both sides of any issue have confirmation bias. Mm-hmm. And I often speak to my students about this, and generally library people, which is who I educate, are like quite progressive. Like we're quite progressive thinkers. We're like on the side of good for everyone. You know, we believe in climate change, all those sorts of things. And I will say to them, like, you will also get stuck into an echo chamber of climate change is true. Let's just use that as an example that could lead you astray into certain like areas of information that is not true. Like you also need to like pull back and look at the other side of the issue and consider that, you know, every view that you have is not necessarily correct either, even though you think it's the good view or the right view. So perhaps a comment section could operate in that way. I do feel like on a lot of media sources, though, comment sections are sort of getting shut down or I feel like they're not like the breeding ground that they once were. You just need to be aware that it's a well-rounded issue. And even if you are the progressive thinker, you get stuck too. You will get stuck too into like certain things. Like I like electronic cars is like something that I think, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if I want to bring this up because I don't actually know any facts about it, but I feel like at one point I was like, yeah, electronic cars. And then like after learning some facts, I was like, oh, maybe they're not good for the environment, actually. Yeah. Like I thought they were. But wait, which is good? Which is bad? I don't know. I'm not a scientist. Like I have no idea. So it's, I can't really have a strong opinion about what sort of cars people should drive. And that's sort of what people need to get back to is like, why are you fighting this fight?
Mm.
Why are you online fighting this fight if you are not an expert and you don't actually understand the issue that you're looking at?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe leave it to the experts and the, I can't remember what you referred to it as, Alexa, like the common consensus.
The really cool thing about confirmation bias is the minute you know it exists is the minute it will stop working. So anyone that's listening has heard that confirmation bias is a thing, and now they will be slightly more aware next time they see something that it is happening to them. It's less likely to continue. As soon as you know about it, it goes away.
Thanks for listening to What Is True. Remember, when something makes you gasp, pause, check the source, and think before you share. And keep your hippos in the imagination, not the kitchen cabinet.
Just next week for another deep dive with Nina and Diane. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and ring that bell so you never miss another truth bomb.